Guys, the U.S. Department of Education is gone. Its budget, poof. So, what happens to the billions of dollars that it used to control? Who's in charge of the education funding now? And more importantly, how does this impact teachers, students, and schools? Today, we follow the money and uncover the truth about education funding after the DOE. Get ready, because this one's going to hit hard on the Traveling Principal Show. All right, so before we even talk about where the money went, we need to understand how much was in play. And this is an interesting one here that's kind of driven a lot of my research throughout the last week. That the U.S. Department of Education spent $268 billion last year. Billion. That was only 4% of the actual annual federal budget, which is really also gnarly that they cut $268 billion, and that's only 4%. That said, let's move forward. So that $268 is not divided by the number of states and then allocated equally. Each state, it varies depending on a couple of different statistics, and I will dive into that with you guys in this episode here because it's very important that you understand it. And so the big picture is, let's look at the year 2020 to 2021. I was able to find some accurate statistics there. The U.S. spent an average of about $18,000 per student, right? So some states less, some states more. But let's take a look at less and more and which state spent specific amounts, because it's pretty interesting to hear, a vast amount is given and how it's allocated. So what you have to understand before we go any further is that education funding in the U.S. is not equal, and it never has been. Some states invest heavily in their schools, while others barely spend enough to keep the lights on. And so let me show you what I'm talking about so you don't think I'm just knocking states, okay? I'm going to bring up this here website. It's on niced.gov, so it's as reliable as we could possibly get our hands on at this point in time. And so you'll see here that it will support what I'm talking about. So a state like New York, let's have a look-see, and I'll go over it with you guys. So New York spends $32,000 per kid. So every kid in the state of New York that's walking around costs the state $32,000. Now, New York State doesn't give all $32,000. It gets subsidies from the federal government. And I'll explain to you what that looks like. But at this section, I want you to also see, like, California spends $19,000, a lot less. Okay. Utah spends $12,000. And Idaho spends $11,000. Now, this is interesting because then you also have D.C., which I never really quite understood what was going on in the District of Columbia. But they're saying, they're reporting on here that they are spending $37,000. A second site has D.C. just a little bit behind New York. So I'm uncertain as to which is real there. So don't quote me and hold me over the flames to that one. But the point that I'm really trying to make here is, regardless to the number within the state and the amount that that state is paying, there is quite a discrepancy. So it's a $20,000 gap between what New York or DC is spending and what Idaho and Utah are spending. So in high spending states, the obvious, right? Teachers can be paid competitive salaries, keep some sizes, class sizes smaller, offer more advanced courses, technologically advanced courses, technology, period, extracurricular activities, maintain modern, well-funded buildings that are safe and push the boundaries of education. Low spending states like Utah or Idaho, in this example here, teachers are paid a lot less, leading to a very high turnover. Schools lack specific resources, such as perhaps textbooks, technology, or even some of the basics. Large class sizes usually take over and make individualized instruction nearly impossible. I'm not saying that it is, but that's before we even factor in Title I funding. Okay, and the federal money meant to help level the playing field, we most commonly call Title I. It's a federal safety net for low-income schools. And so for decades, Title I funding has helped low-income schools by providing federal dollars for additional teachers to reduce class sizes, academic support for struggling students, special education, and English learner programs. A lot of the times, and I'll explain to you the funding formula for Title I as well, but it doesn't fully close the funding gap. Some high-need districts just, they'll never get enough to catch up. I don't think Title I is it'll make a dent, but it's not going to be the solution there. And so now with the U.S. Department of Education gone, Title I is gone too. And so New York and D.C. receive high per-pupil Title I funding to match their larger number of low-income students. Whereas Utah, Kansas, Idaho receive far less. Utah gets about $1,311 per student. Kansas, $1,500. Both way below the national average of $1,700 per student. Okay, so that means that even with Title I, Utah, Idaho, Kansas, they're struggling to fund their schools fairly. And now with no more federal funding, those schools are entirely dependent on state budgets to survive. So that's a bit alarming. All right, so it is a bit alarming, but let's learn, right? Because I don't want to just placate to emotions and get everybody all fired up. I want you to be educated about this, and that's what the show is about. So without Title I, we now have a completely state-controlled education system. So what happens next? The following are what I think are some options, but let's let them play out. So wealthy states like New York will keep investing in their schools. I definitely think that that's going to be a trend. Low-income states, already underfunded, will continue to struggle. Rural and underfunded schools, especially those that depend on Title I, will absolutely be hit the hardest. So for decades, Title I was the last lifeline for many struggling schools. And now that it's gone. And so the question is, will states step up and invest in education, or will students be left behind? And I want to talk about that a little bit here. So really quickly, we're talking about where the money used to come from. The federal government contributed about 13.7% of public school funding overall. So that's a giant chunk that's going to be taken away. That percentage wasn't evenly spread. Alaska got the most federal funding per student. And again, while we're seeing states like Utah, Kansas, Idaho did not. Areas that I do think are going to be impacted most: special education, low-income support, Title I funding, all dependent heavily on federal dollars. I want to just touch upon each of those really quickly. As a principal, I can explain to you why special education would be underfunded. Simply already because it is. And so if you have one kid in a classroom and that kid requires one teacher all day long, and that school has 8 periods a day, or if you're an elementary school, you get one teacher per kid. Awesome. The amount of money that you're being given for that kid, which on an average was about $18,000, that is going to salary, fringe, all kinds of different things, resources, allocations that make the school's functioning system, okay? If you take a kid now that has a need within their educational path that requires more than one teacher, so they may need a specific expert in a specific field. Let's say something like speech and language, right? That person now has to see a speech and language provider every week. They don't need just one teacher, they actually need more. And so right away, they're gonna cost a little bit more. Now again, out of that $18K that on average that kid will bring into that school, that may be okay. You may be still cutting it. But it's not designed for much more than that. Some students also have occupational therapy. Some students need to see a counselor or a psychologist or some sort of social worker weekly. Some students have to do all of these things, seen in group and then individual settings. Some students need two teachers in the room at all times with a specific support aid, instructional aid as well. So now you're dealing with three full-time for one student. And that 18K has been burned through a long time ago. And so when you have a giant population of students, and when I say giant, you guys, I'm talking about on average, the last four schools I've worked in, and I'm dating back to 2007, they have all had at least 20% special education. So 20% of the kids that go there require this staffing demand. And you can see if you take that away, which would offset that cost. We already were struggling to try to figure out how to pay for it with the federal dollars, with Title I. Any person in special education in the United States will tell you the same exact thing. It's never funded properly. It's 100% underfunded. In every state, in every school, I don't care who you think you are, and you guys have done it better, I absolutely disagree without knowing. I just can. It doesn't make any sense when you think about the logic I was just speaking about, right? Unless I can't even think of a way. So now you have low income coupled with that, okay? When I say low income, what do we mean there that draws on the demand of a school that maybe in addition to what the average student requires, you may need lunch, breakfast services provided for that student. You may need transportation provided for that student. You may need social work, counseling, family therapy, some sort of engagement with the home life provided for that student. In addition to instructional support before, after, and the extended week of the school day. So there's a large in addition category for low income special education that Title I would support. In addition, Title I was challenging to spend for any administrator. There were specifics tied to it. And so you couldn't just say, oh yeah, my school got all this money, we can spend it on everything under the sun. It was to supplant what was currently in existence, not to substitute. And so it was quite a challenge, which usually meant professional development days for staff were before or after the school year, or during the middle in a break, again, before or after the semester or school year. And so it supplanted the regular school year and counted under Title I funds. And I used to spend money on professional development for staff. And that's when we really got a lot of our work done. And now you're taking that away. And so what that means is if I'm gonna continue to do that, that money still has to come from somewhere. Okay, so now that the Department of Education is gone and that $267 bill goes with them, where did it go? Let's talk about that, right? So let's talk about these in three possible scenarios. Scenario one, the money is sent back to the states as block grants. So kind of as is, right? I'm a little weirded out by this one because a lot of stuff has been said about this not being the case. And if it is, awesome. We go right back to where we were. Some states may invest more in education while others may cut funding and reallocate. Some potential upsides. Local control means states can make targeted investments in schools. When I came to California, they started the Local Control Accountability Plan, the LCAP, which meant my school district was able to use its own needs to dictate how spending was moving forward, which I didn't mind. A tedious process, but they've ironed it out over the last couple of years. The dangers here, some states could divert education dollars to other priorities, such as infrastructure, tax cuts, or even government programs. And that's a little scary about scenario one. So if the money gets sent back to the states, each state gets to do what they want with it. right now it's all being spent at the, you know, for one cause. Scenario two, funding comes from local taxes. So without federal support, school funding becomes entirely state and locally funded. So wealthy districts will thrive because they're paying higher taxes, while low-income areas take a huge hit. This deepens inequality, makes child education dependent on zip code, and this is super dangerous. I do not recommend scenario two. There's a really good chance, though. So there's that. And then scenario three, the private sector steps in. Scenario two and scenario three are pretty on par with about the same, which would make, I guess, all three about the same. But that said, scenario three is seeming like it's the route things may go. The private sector may step in. So vouchers, school choice programs, and privatization will surge. And I do know some people that I was speaking to just recently on the voucher program that are in the private school systems on the East Coast, and they had nothing good to say about vouchers. And so I'd like to pick his brain a little bit more and find out more about what Tim's saying. But supporters argue that this empowers parents with more choices. And I can see that, right? Critics say it undermines public education, which leaves struggling schools behind. And so it's kind of like, well, that one didn't work, so let's go to the next one and try over and start over. And what people don't really understand about schools is that they are not easy to run. And a lot of times people think, oh yeah, I can do that a lot better. These people have no idea what they're talking about. On and on and on they go with their ideas and their thoughts and their intentions, and they are way off. They're way off. And so I would wonder what this last one here is going to look like, scenario three. It sounds a lot more sleazy than I think it may turn out. And so I think it's got to offset scenario two, which would be, you know, local taxes as the only funding source in addition to what the states are bringing in. Otherwise, we're going to start to see a giant discrepancy. And if you're thinking that this sounds like the Wild West of education, you're absolutely right. All right, so let's continue with the Debbie Downer episode here. Real world consequences for schools and teachers. I just want to be transparent so you guys aren't caught off guard. You know, teacher pay and job security. So without federal support, teachers' salaries will vary more now than ever. Some states may invest, others may cut. We've said this a few times on the show, but no more federal student loan forgiveness for teachers means fewer incentives to stay in the profession. When I became a teacher, I had somebody walk into a classroom while the class was being taught. She was the advisor. And she had said, is anybody interested in teaching in New York City? They have this giant demand. On and on she went, and they'll pay for your summer. It was called the Summer in the City Internship Program, which I absolutely loved. And so I took them up on that offer and began my career. Pretty interesting to think that if that wasn't around and that never happened, the Summer in the City Internship Program, because I remember starting with a slew of other educators, and everybody really was stoked on having the gig because they were thinking of doing something else, or they were doing something else, and now this is where they landed. And so without these types of incentive programs, I'm a little concerned as to what's going to happen there with the demand of a teacher. Special education in low-income schools, which we already spoke about, are a real issue. So Individuals with Disabilities Act, IDEA, federal funded. So now that's up to the states. You can't just say we're not going to have SPED anymore. I just don't see that happening. But what happens when a state doesn't want to pay for special education, I'm uncertain. And I'm a little nervous about that answer, because what I just said is going to clash in the next couple weeks here. The gap between wealthy and poor schools will widen dramatically, and that's something that we really need to start to understand is going to play out. It can't not. Curriculum and testing, federal education standards like Common Core are probably going to be gone. States will have to adopt their own and I'm a little nervous about that. Each state now is free to create its own education system, leading to 50 different approaches to learning. And some states are going to innovate, while others may weaken altogether. So who wins in this new education landscape and who loses? Let's talk about that really quickly. So winners, states that already fund education well, New York, Massachusetts, families in wealthy districts that don't rely on federal support, private schools, charter schools, and education investors. Oh, God. Definitely they win. I'm nervous there. I have this theory that I've been talking about for a long time, that it's the big education publication companies that have ruined public education. And now they're going to be taken over. Losers, low-income students are going to be at a loss here while they relied on federal support for meals and special programs. Teachers in states that slashed budgets instead of investing in education. And rural and underfunded districts, which have the have to fight for every dollar. I'm a little nervous for both of them. So what does this mean for all of us, you guys? What happens next, right? Teachers need to advocate for strong education budgets at a state level. Now is the best time to stick together, right? School leaders must get creative, securing grants, forming partnerships, and innovating. Parents will have to pay close attention to how their states allocate funding, and businesses. I say all the time that schools are going to inform the community. But at this point in time, the community may need to keep the schools alive. And so I'm going to throw that one on there as well. Without a safety net, a federal safety net for the future of education, it's now in local hands. So some states will thrive, others maybe not so much. What do you think? Would your state fund education fairly, or would schools be left behind? I hope that this was able to, I was able to clear some of this up for you guys so you understand where the money went or where it's going to go. Some different solutions as to what may happen here moving forward, how the federal government was funding schools, and what we're going to do now that they're not. So thanks for tuning into the Traveling Principal Show, you guys. If you found this episode eye-opening, make sure to subscribe, share, like this episode. Stay connected. Until next time, keep navigating education with me, one journey at a time. My name is Joe Clossy. Thanks for listening. So Traveling Principal Joe Clossy here, you guys. Just wanted to give a special shout out to my friends and family back east. I know they've been watching. I've been seeing them all over social media, giving my stuff a lot of love. And so I just wanted to say thanks. All my family and friends back in Kingston, like old Kev says, where the hood meets the country. Thanks, you guys, for listening. I keep it up just for you guys.